and welcome to Conservation Connections. I'm Beth Summers. I'm the Executive Director at Valley Stewardship Network here in Viroqua, Wisconsin. And our guest today is someone who's been a longtime consultant for Valley Stewardship Network as a whole farm stewardship planner, Jim Munch. Jim is a Vernon County farmer and a lifelong advocate for soil conservation in our area. Jim studied agricultural engineering at Purdue University, planning to take over his family's farm in Indiana until that farm was sold for a flood control project. And that twist led Jim on a wide-ranging career, from earning a master's in management to serving in the U.S. Army and working internationally, including several years in Japan. Eventually, Jim followed his heart back to farming. He and his family settled on a ridgetop farm here in Vernon County, where he has been raising grass-fed beef and sharing his expertise on sustainable grazing and soil health. He now lives just a mile from Coon Valley, the birthplace of soil conservation, and is bringing his story full circle. So welcome, Jim. So great to have you in the studio today.
Good to be here.
So, Jim, maybe you can give us a little background. What do we mean when we say managed grazing or alternately rotational grazing? We kind of use those two terms interchangeably, but what are we referring to?
That's a very important starting point because grazing can mean many things to many people. And there is a history of grazing here in the county, in all this part of Wisconsin, because of the dairy industry. And so that's what we think of when we think of pastures and grazing. But what we're talking about is a higher level of management of animals on the land. And the short definition of managed grazing is that you allow an animal to eat a plant only so far down so that you don't kill the plant, and then move the animal to another place to eat another plant and allow the first plant that the animal ate to grow back. And in the spring, that's a very short cycle. Later in the year, as things slow down in growth rates, it's a longer cycle. And the farmer managing that, or the rancher, some people like to call them ranchers, is in charge of that moving of the animals from one place to the other. That's managed grazing.
So that cycle that you're describing of allowing pasture to regenerate before it has been grazed on for too long, that's much more similar, isn't it, to what the original ungulates on our landscape, the bison here, would have been doing?
We have learned from nature, and it is not something that somebody invented. They just observed exactly what nature was doing, not only on our continent, but in Africa. In the ranges in Africa and in parts of Europe, that they just observed how ruminants managed to get fresh grass all the time.
And I want to just start off by debunking this widely held myth that raising livestock is bad for the environment, bad for water quality, bad for soils, because when done in this way, it really does mimic what our soils and our vegetation would have been adapted to, doesn't it?
That's exactly right. That's how the Great Plains ended up with 7 to 8 feet of topsoil, rich, wonderful, alive topsoil that has sustained modern agriculture for years in the Plains area, the Great Plains area. It was because of what the buffalo have done for centuries.
Yeah, and I'm glad you talked about that that rich topsoil that was in our area, because that's been a long-term concern. Especially here in the Driftless area where we have this steep topography, we've experienced some just incredible soil losses over the last couple hundred years, haven't we?
A scientist from one of the universities in the east, on the East Coast, and I forget which one it is, did some satellite imaging of the topsoil of all of this in all of the counties from the western counties of Wisconsin all the way to Nebraska. And if you look at Vernon County, La Crosse County, we've lost about 50% of all of our topsoil in the last couple hundred years since settlers came to Wisconsin.
Yeah, just an incredible loss to our farmers. Yeah. And then all of that soil is ending up down in our valleys, in the streams, and really contributing to the loss of our in-stream habitat for what's another very important economic resource for us, right? The trout fishing.
That's exactly right. It's and, you know, when I went to school years and years ago, we were focused on the loss of soil, but what I guess I missed in some class is that soil brings with it phosphorus and other nutrients, which are, some of them are bad actors. Phosphorus is a bad actor. And so we have these deposits of phosphorus that exist on our stream banks. As in history, as flooding happened, the phosphorus-borne soil that was in the water was deposited on these stream banks. And so we have a lot of what people call heritage or residual phosphorus. And as I said, phosphorus is a bad actor.
Yeah, and that's really a problem that everyone should be concerned about, whether they're a fisherman or not, because we all need water that is drinkable. And even the folks way downstream of us in the Gulf of Mexico are seeing the impact of that phosphorus coming down and creating really what has become a huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico.
Exactly. Right? That's right. And if you look at from the farmer's standpoint, all that phosphorus that we've lost has to be replaced in the form of fertilizer. And the fertilizer has to come from someplace. And in the case of phosphorus, we have plenty in the United States so far, but it's playing out. The other fertilizers that we use in agriculture come from other countries. And as a matter of fact, in potash, which is another typical fertilizer, it comes, 95% of it comes from outside the United States, from places that aren't always our friends.
Mm-hmm. I want to circle back because you mentioned flooding. Another big problem, in addition to soil loss that comes with that water running off the landscape quickly, is this really intense flood pulse that we're seeing more and more in recent years. And it's been a hot topic in our area as we're losing a lot of our small flood control dams here in the near future. And a lot of people have been impacted by recent large floods and by a couple dam breaches, especially in 2018, we had some really big ones. So flood control is an emerging issue that we really need to think about. How does this all tie back to rotational grazing?
Well, if you look at data, long-term data, 25 to 30-year data out of the University of Wisconsin, and if you look at work that is done by NRCS, which is what the Natural Resource
Conservation Service.
That if you cover the land with a growing plant and if you have healthy soil, you can capture much more water than if the land is bare and doesn't have something growing on it. And it's a factor of two, so or half, if you look at it from the standpoint of bare land versus a plant growing on the land, totally blanketing the land, almost a shield. With rotational grazing, over time, you build soil health so that the soil, when you dig it up, would look like cottage cheese, black cottage cheese, with a lot of voids in it that hold water. And then the plants themselves break the water, the force of the rain coming down, so you're capturing more water upstream. And in very practical terms, if you go out on a farm that has been in managed grazing for a long time, and if it's done well, and if it has good plants growing on it, the water that may run off is clear, because it is not going into the soil and off. It's running off a saturated soil. So it's basically very clear water. If you look at a recently plowed field, or not moldboard plow, but any kind of tillage, the water that comes off the field will have soil in it. And so that's not only taking erosion, but it'll be about twice the volume if it's bare soil. So that, while managed grazing doesn't stop runoff, it mitigates it. It smooths it out. It holds the water up on the ridge. And we live on a ridge farm. When the big flood hit Coon Valley, we had a lot of spongy soil that kept a lot of water from being part of that event. But it was a dramatic event for the people in Coon Valley.
Yeah, and you hit on what is really our best tool to preventing that from happening again: perennial vegetation on the landscape. So, you know, short of asking everyone to take their land out of production and put it in native prairie, which would certainly help with that, managed grazing offers a tool that allows farmers to make income while still fixing this problem of water shooting off of their land too quickly.
That's right. And on the income side, which is where I spend a lot of time studying and helping people with, if you have a well-managed pasture along the lines that we talked about before, it is the cheapest feed that you can put into a ruminant by a factor of about 4. The alternative would be to harvest the forage in the form of hay or silage and take it off the land and feed the animal someplace else besides on the land where the plant grew. And that's just an accumulation of cost. And the biggest cost in a system like that, or one of the bigger costs, is the fact that you're taking nutrients off with all of those plants that you take off the land, and you have to replace them in the form of commercial fertilizer. And so not only is it good for the soil, is it good for runoff and erosion control, but it can be a very effective economic tool in raising ruminants.
Would you say that it's economically maybe even more profitable in the long run for a farmer to graze in this way compared to a continuous grazing style?
The numbers say something like this, that if you had a 1,000-pound animal, which is about a Holstein heifer, ready to have a calf, that's about a 1,000-pound animal. A 1,000-pound, it costs, with well-managed pasture, about 20 cents a day to 50 cents a day. Let's say an average of 40 cents a day to keep that animal. If you harvested the forage, stored the forage, fed the forage, and all the waste involved in that, you're up around $2.25, $2.40 per head per day for that same animal. So how you use that is really up to the producer. How, depending on the technology of how often you move the cattle, what is growing in your pasture, how you handle the pasture, you can have yields that approach hay yields in our area. And so the amount of forage is equivalent. But in one case, it's $20. It's this, going back to what it costs to feed a 1,000-pound animal, you're talking about 20 cents at 40, let's say 40 cents a day, versus the two plus dollars per day per head that if you had harvested, taken it back, and then hauled that animal's waste away in the process. So, yes, it's economically viable.
And then what about on the marketing end? Do we have a market that can support and reward farmers for making the switch to this grass-fed system?
Well, the interesting thing about that is that all that we're talking about, that I've been talking about, is a cost element to raising cattle. If you can reduce that cost, how you make money on selling that animal or the products of that animal, in the case of dairy, is up to you. But if you look at, for instance, this fictitious 1,000-pound animal I was talking about, and let's say that you could graze that animal for 180 days, and you versus having it in confinement and carrying feed to it, the difference between 40 cents a day and, let's say, to make the math very simple, $2.40 a day is $2. So for 180 days, you could save $2 per day to raise that animal, or $360 saved in raising that animal. With a dairy heifer, the average cost of raising a dairy heifer in the upper Midwest is about $2,200, $2,000 plus. If you can save $360 of that $2,200, that's about what? 15-20%, something like that? No, not that much. 15-16%. That's a big deal for the dairy industry. And in fact, right now, when dairymen, large dairymen, have to get replacements for their herd, a lot of those are grazed, but they're not grazed in Wisconsin. They're shipped off to Nebraska or Kansas, which is more in tune with the type, those states, the farmers in those states are more in tune with a grazing concept. There's no reason why we couldn't do that in Wisconsin. And so that's how cost avoidance is one way. Another way to make money at this is to catch the eaters, the consumers' concept of grass-fed. There is research that says that milk from grass-fed dairy cows, meat from grass-fed cattle, sheep, etc., has health benefits. And all of this is very controversial in conventional ag because the science on it is creeping up on, is that good for a person? And the science would say probably is, but it isn't all tied down. So it's somewhat controversial, but not for a number of people in the consuming world that are tuned into the health benefits of a grass-fed animal.
And in terms of the health for the animal, there's some considerable benefits, aren't there?
Less leg problems. Getting back to because we're a dairy state, we look at dairy quite a bit. If you look at a dairy heifer that has a calf, the likelihood of a twisted stomach, the likelihood of other issues around birthing are much less if the animal's been raised in a pasture setting. And in the first lactation, the first tranche of milk that you get out of that animal, you probably have a 4-5% increase in production because the animal comes in physically fit, so to speak, and is able to, the body is able to make more milk. And so there are not only the economic benefit of cost avoidance of raising the animal, but there are some ongoing health things that in a farmer's view means money, because you have to have a veterinarian come in, you have to take the animal off of production, and I'm not even putting money on that, but if you're a dairy producer, you understand that costs money.
So there's some pretty compelling reasons why a farmer might want to make the switch to either from crop production or from continuous grazing to rotational grazing. What would be the steps involved in getting started in that for someone?
Well, that it takes land. You're going to take land out of production of other crops. It takes a fencing infrastructure to move the animals where you want them to eat in a particular day. In nature, that is done by animals being subject to predation, and they move because of that, and animals move because there's no more grass left. But in a farming situation, a ranching situation, you do that move. So you have to learn that technology. You have to have an infrastructure that will facilitate making those moves. And frankly, the investment of that is something less than the cost of a machine to cut hay. You know, we're talking a very small amount of money to get started with the infrastructure and planting the plants that you need. And on top of it, because it is a conservation plus, NRCS will cost share some of that cost.
Is NRCS probably the best resource for farmers needing financial assistance for getting started?
That's a good place to start, but more and more, there are nonprofits that are doing similar work, and local land and water departments. By local, I mean county level, land and water departments have some funds that they've been able to expend if people want to convert cropland to pasture.
And then as far as getting advice and mentorship, what avenues are there that a starting out grazier might get into to get some peer support?
Back to those two governmental organizations, the County Land and Water and NRCS, both have technical capabilities to assist farmers. But I really encourage people to seek out other farmers that are already grazing and pick their brain. That can be done in a somewhat formal way. In our area, we're very lucky because we have a couple of active grazing groups that facilitate learning by having meetings on farms where grazing is taking place and looking at right down on the ground at the items that they're using, the methods they're using, the plants that they're growing, and how they're managing. So you learn from the way that farmers have learned for my whole lifetime, and that is by getting together and looking at what other farmers are doing.
Yeah, and actually, weren't you just part of a pasture walk that was held by the Great River Grazers?
Yesterday, in the cold and rain. Yes, and we had 18, 20 people, something like that there. Some newbies and some people with 30 years of grazing experience. And we had sort of it was interesting. It was the moderator of it. It's the Great River Grazers group. And I, instead of teaching or talking or yammering at people, we discussed problems and how each of those 18, 20 people, if they were grazing, how did they solve that problem on their land? And so it was a good exchange of, and sometimes a little argument about how things should be done. But that's how you learn.
Jim, in our last few minutes, I wonder if you'd be willing to just give us a quick snapshot of what your farm is like, how many head you have, how often you rotate, how much time that's
taking.
So
our farm, we bought that farm in 76. It's a hilltop farm. We have only 100 acres, about 40 of it open. I rent a farm next to mine because the owner of the land was interested in what we do to the land. how that looks on his land. And of course, we pay rent. And then we rent some pasture from someone who had pasture, and as a dairyman, he sold his cows, but wanted to keep the pasture in pasture for tax reasons, for aesthetics, and just felt it was good for the land. So 40 acres owned, about 50, 60 acres rented in various ways. And we have a cow-calf operation of about 30 head. And then we keep those animals and finish them. We sell grass-fed beef online. The kids do it. They have enough people that can buy us out. But what if we aren't bought out? We sell to a fairly recently started great organization called the Wisconsin Grass-Fed Beef Cooperative, and we're a member of that cooperative, and they will buy grass-fed beef from us. They try to be at a premium above the market, and if you direct market meat, freezer beef, we sometimes call it in this field, you can actually give people a good price and sell your animals at above the price that you could sell in a auction a sales barn. So that's our operation, and our farm is totally covered up with grass. For 35 years, it's been covered up with grass. The farm next to ours is hay and some pasture, again, covered up. And you have to realize that on a ridgetop close to Coon Creek, we have land that goes from 25% slope to 5%. There is no flat land on our 100 acres. And so one of the reasons we got started in this was exactly to stop erosion on the land. I mean, I was raised on a hog farm, and the idea of being on a farm and raising hogs with all the grain that you have to put into those kind of animals was tough on the land. And so we've brought the first cattle on the farm in 81. So that's a few years ago.
Yeah, well, I want to thank you for all that you've done on your own land, and then, you know, even more so for serving as a great example and a mentor for all the other farmers in our area that are interested in following suit. It's such a good model for how we can move agriculture forward, especially in our tenuous landscape here in the Driftless area. So really appreciate you coming into the studio, Jim. It was great to see you again today.
Good to see you, and I love talking about it. It's a good system. Thank you.